Hello and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. My name is Dan Dixon.
My name's Joseph Earp.
And today we are talking about Ocean's 11.
When I said to our guest who has joined us today, would you like to come on the podcast I do about Brad Pitt? Our guest, like, the you were like, I think this film that we're talking about today is one of my favourite films ever made. Or did you say the favourite film ever made?
I don't think I said the favourite, but it's definitely one of, I think in a way that I conceptualized before rewatching it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So rewatching hurt it a little bit?
I don't think it hurt it, but it definitely made me, like, notice a ton of stuff that I hadn't noticed the first, like, few times, I guess.
So we're joined by Alex Gallagher, writer and musician and longtime friend of me. and Brad Pitt, Stan? Do you like Brad Pitt?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I think in a way that I didn't realize, like, when I was preparing to come on the podcast, I, like, went to his Wikipedia and, like, looked at the filmography, and I was like, there's actually fucking heaps of movies here that I really rate. It's kind of funny, because a lot of them I don't even think of being, like, Brad Pitt oriented or something.
Like Megamind, you're not like all about Brad Pitt in Megamind.
I don't think I've seen Megamind.
I don't think I've seen Megamind.
Neither have I, but we will.
We will. He's in Happy Feet 2.
These are the films I've...
What are the ones you really rate then?
I really like Interview with a Vampire.
I had forgotten how much I liked that film until I rewatched it for this podcast. I was like, this is high camp queer romance.
Yeah, 100%.
Like,
yeah.
So good.
Absolutely.
Have you seen all of the Ocean's movies, though?
I have. I haven't seen 12 or 13 in, like, quite some time, but I definitely have seen them. I rewatched Ocean's 8 for this, which I know isn't a Brad Pitt film, but...
Yeah. How is it? Is it? I have never seen Ocean's 8.
Really?
So you're our Ocean's 8 expert. Okay.
Yeah. It's good. I think that it's, like... I have lots of conflicted feelings about, like, gender swap reboots or whatever, but I think that Ocean's 8 stacks up particularly well if you forget that Ocean's 11 exists. Like, if you think of it as a standalone film, it's a lot of fun. In the same way that I think Ocean's 11 is a lot of fun, yeah, maybe sometimes, like, gender swap reboots have a lot of pressure or onus on
them. They're dependent on the gender swapping as, like, the quality or whatever, you know?
And also, I think, expected to, like, take away the sins or something, like, of...
Sure, it's absolution.
Yeah, 100%. I think if you ignore that and just take it, like, as a film, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
It's got a really good cast, right? Isn't
it's
it?
Incredible, like, incredible cast.
Cate Blanchett.
Yes.
In that
Cate Blanchett,
green suit.
Sandra Bullock. Rihanna.
Rihanna.
Yeah. Yep.
What a Rihanna, like, filmography. Isn't she in, like... the film based on the board game Battleship, Ocean's 8.
Right, yeah.
Like, she's got, like, four.
She was
credits.
In that film with Donald Glover that was on Amazon Prime. It was, like, dropped under Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
I did not watch.
I didn't see that either.
No.
From what I saw, like, Donald Glover really went hard on promoting that, and Rihanna kind of, like, didn't even tweet about it or something, which is a huge power move. Like, oh my god,
she doesn't have to do nothing.
Right?
She
yeah, totally.
No. She's like, whatever. I had a mismemory about the film Ocean's 11, which I think I've recounted on this podcast before, that I said that, like, a formative thing for me was my dad would sometimes go to the cinema. Like, my parents were aware that I loved movies, but they largely didn't, so we didn't go. So, like, going out with my dad was a special expedition. And I clearly remember desperately wanting to go and see Saw. And dad being like...
How old were you?
Yeah, how old?
Well, see, this is the mismemory. I was like, we have to see Saw. And dad was like, no, I'm not seeing Saw. Let's go see Ocean's 11. But Ocean's 11 came out in 2001. Saw came out in 2004. So it's possible that...
Ocean's 12, maybe?
It's possible it was one of the Ocean sequels. Because I remember seeing that whatever Ocean's film I saw and hating it. And being like, "That why the fuck didn't we go and see Saw? Like,
yeah,
I wanted..." Like, the new metal brat that I was. And so when I watched... Because the thing I had remembered... I didn't get to see it. Seesaw. Had to go see this crummy film. And also I remembered a French guy doing like crunking to get through laser security,
which also doesn't happen
in this
maybe
film.
Happens in Ocean's 12. I have seen Ocean's 12 and I know a very long time.
It's possible I had never seen Ocean's 12 really? Before last night.
Wow.
I remember nothing.
See, I remember a lot of it.
Really?
It's really burned into my brain. Heaps of lines, especially there were lines in this film that I thought, I know that was in the trailer. I do not know why. I remember how it was cut for the trailer as well. I don't know why I would have watched the Ocean's 11 trailer a bunch of times. No idea.
Maybe it was on a DVD, like the Austin Powers DVD.
Maybe it was played before. Oh, you know what? I wonder, this 2001... I was obsessed with... I went to see Fellowship of the Ring 9 times in December 2001, which would have been just before Ocean's 11 came out.
Yeah.
In cinemas in Australia, which is early 2002, I think. Yeah. So I bet it played before Fellowship of the Ring. So I was like, there's so much of this. I have also saw the film at the cinemas.
When I rewatched it, I remembered a lot of lines as well.
Did you see it as a child? Did you see it when it first came out?
I don't think I would have seen it at cinemas because I would have been 9. But I definitely saw it like young and I think, remember like really enjoying it.
Another missed memory. I kind of thought, if I didn't see it at the cinemas, did I see it at like school camp? It feels like quite a like,
sure.
Here's a film, but I think I saw the remake of The Italian Job at school camp, which is like feels similar in my head.
Yeah, totally.
Sure.
Because this film started and I remember being... My first thought was like, I don't... Prison? What the fuck? Is this a flashback? Like, I didn't know what the fuck was going on. And then halfway through, I was like, George Clooney is not very good in this movie. And I hadn't remembered thinking that either. So, like, it's possible that yesterday was the first time I experienced Ocean's 11.
Hmm.
And you know what? Pretty good.
It's a pretty good film.
It's a pretty good movie.
Pretty good movie. It's
why was it film. Your... Why was it, like, top tier, one of your favourites?
I think that it's, I don't know, like, it's just so goofy.
Mm.
And in a way that, like, I don't know, I think maybe when I was a bit younger, I thought was interesting. I mean, it also, I think, is a very, like not personally, but I imagine for a lot of people, it's got, like, a certain, like, wish fulfillment bravado element totally. To it that's a lot of fun, I think.
You don't personally want to like rip off 3 casinos in Vegas and like
do a
backflip in order to jump over some security.
They make it seem equally more and less stressful than I imagine an actual heist is at once.
That's true.
It is.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Well, because it's one of the big things that I was struck by the end of the movie. It is a tense film, but it's somehow a tense film without being so because of the threat of death.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, Andy Garcia is the villain of this film, and I think in most other movies, there would be some kind of scene where he, like, beats a henchman up for saying the wrong thing, sure. or, like, shoots up, or there's guns, or gunfire, or violence.
Yeah.
This is weirdly, despite featuring, I guess, some inappropriate stuff for kids, it's basically a PG movie.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
There's no blood. When George Clooney gets punched in the face, it's kind of a joke.
Yeah.
So I don't know why it's
true.
Tense.
Yeah, there's very little violence.
Yeah, almost none. Yeah. Like, what happens? He gets punched by a guy it turns out that he knows. Is that it?
And his friends... And it's like, the punching is a ruse.
Like, they don't even... Like, when they have to deal with guards, they, like, smoke bomb them or whatever.
Yeah.
That's true. It's like a Batman video again.
Yeah. Or Power Rangers. Yeah. I was thinking weirdly. It's like, you know when you're a kid and you think that one of the weird ways movies condition you, that you just think, like, if you punch a guy in the head, he'll just go to sleep and wake up, like, in 2 hours. Yeah. Like, I remember saying to my dad, like, is that how it works? You can just, like... Like, every human being just has an off switch.
Yeah.
And you can snap it.
Well, I mean...
I'm just moving it very quickly to the
side. It's a super, like, tropey... superhero thing, because obviously none of them are allowed to kill people, so you have to like incapacitate them without like
limited
seriously
force.
Injuring them or anything. So it's like, oh, okay, I guess if I throw a punch, they'll just be out for as long as it takes for me to do what I need to do, but they'll be ultimately fine.
Maybe I shouldn't say this on the podcast, because I do sometimes think maybe I'll like write this script, but I've always wanted to make a movie that starts like an action set piece from a spy film, like a James Bond guy, like shooting everyone and jumping through the windows and doing acrobatics and like very high tension. And then the James Bond character kind of walks out of shot, having subdued the bad guy, and there's just chaos left in his wake. And then the next hour and a half of the film is those people trying to, like, rebuild their lives.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
I love that. Like, the henchman who got shot in the leg, like, the film follows his journey through rehabilitation.
Well, it's interesting because the one instance of, like, quite intense violence in Ocean's 11 is when Brad Pitt, like, rescues Don Cheadle and sets off all those bombs.
Yeah.
And it's like so... It's kind of difficult to believe that no one is injured by...
And also that they can just walk away pretty easily.
Yeah, totally.
From after blowing up a bunch of cops.
Yeah, yeah. They just like smoothly, casually...
Yeah.
Stroll away.
Brad Pitt is also definitely doing a riff on his Seven performance in that scene. Don't you think? It's like a self-conscious joke.
Yeah.
Like he stylized the same as his character in Seven. What were you going to say?
I was thinking before what you were saying about that script. It's kind of like Kick-Ass is in that vein of that kind of that philosophy. And also that cop film starring, was it Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg? The Other Guys?
The Other Guys?
Which is kind of, what I thought you were going to, the path you were going to go down. But I prefer yours. The Other Guys is pretty funny.
The Other Guys, I think, has one of the most transcendent jokes in modern cinema when the two hardened cops... just jump off the roof and just die. Doesn't the narration say, like, nobody knows what
why they did it? Yeah. They thought that, it's very... I like that, which is... Ocean's 11 is kind of a film that is parodying, right? Like, the kind of slick undertaking of these cliched genre tropes that things kind of work out smoothly. And you don't really want to ask too many questions about how, like, certain coincidences happen.
Yeah, totally.
The Other Guys, like, opens with that and then falls apart.
Yeah.
But Ocean's 11 kind of just allows it to coast the whole way through.
I mean, lots to say contextually about Ocean's 11 and about interesting things in the film. The first thing that struck me after I had watched it was, like, this film is entirely about a heist of three casinos.
But isn't it just one? Like, do they actually they have three? I don't understand.
Have a joint.
That was really confusing to me.
Yeah, totally.
So they just... I thought they were going to rob three casinos at once, but they just seem to be robbing one same vault.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't make sense that, like, when he's explaining the plan to Brad Pitt, he's like, it's three. Like, it's not really three.
It's one vault.
It's one vault connected to three. Right?
Okay.
But that's the whole film.
Yeah.
I mean, this film is 30% let's get the team... And then, like, 70%, here's the team doing the heist.
Yeah.
To the extent that it reminded me of Titanic, that, like, the heist starts, and I was like, this film has, like, an hour to go.
Yeah.
Like, in the same way that, you know, the ship starts sinking in Titanic, and you're like, I've got a fucking hour and a half.
Totally. I had the same thought. Like, when it got to the point where they'd finished, like, assembling the team, I was like, fuck, this movie's, like, gone on a while. Like,
it's almost entirely montage.
Totally. The whole film is basically montage. Yeah, absolutely.
Which, one of my favourite dramatic tropes is someone describing how something will go over narrating the thing happening. Totally. It's, like, so efficient.
Yeah.
And Ocean's 11 is just almost exclusive.
So the first thing to say contextually, I guess, before we maybe make Dan play the four-sentence game, a deliberately doomed exercise, we have to return to the filmography of Steven Soderbergh, who made this film, who we've weirdly talked about, like, so many times.
He's come up a lot before he's actually appeared on the podcast. I'm not sure why.
So here's the thing. We were talking about it before.
He did Aaron Brockovich, right?
He did Aaron Brockovich and Traffic.
Right, okay, wild.
Not in the same year as this film, right? No, the year before.
Right.
So the crazy thing about his career is he makes Sex, Lies, and Videotape, makes a huge splash, then makes, like, four failures that are still, like, Kafka, King of the Hill, The Underneath, like, these films no one knows. And then he makes Aaron Brockovich and Taxi Driver in Traffic in the same year. Did not direct Taxi Driver, but he would have if he could have. My favourite Soderbergh story is that he was famously, like, a prickly dickhead when he first started making movies, and he made a lot of enemies to the extent that one film producer sent him a note, an anonymous note that says, like, you're a hack, you can't even direct Traffic. And then a couple of years later, he won Best Director for directing Traffic.
Was he deliberate in renaming the film that?
No,
that was a great idea.
Yeah, actually, Traffic.
I'll take this script. Okay.
And then, so he's coming off a massive year, two big films in one year.
Mm.
And then he makes Ocean's 11. I think the 1-2-3 punch of Aaron Brockovich, Traffic, Ocean's 11 means that, like, this is a guy who can make Set any movie he ever wants to make.
Totally.
He can shoot a film for Netflix about basketball on his phone called High Flying Bird. Like,
yeah, he watched that.
Did you? Have you seen that film?
I have not.
It's so boring. It's just so boring.
It seems
and I watched all of The Last Dance. It's about basketball. And
yeah, it's like, The Last Dance.
Yeah, Last Dance is a lot of fun. I mean, it's not that I don't care about basketball. It's the people, it manages to make people in rooms talking about basketball extremely dull. I also just remember it as being entirely grey. Is that right?
Soderbergh movies, for the most part, laying my cards on the table, like, I don't like Steven Soderbergh's movies mostly. Because 98% of them, I think, look like piss. And I mean that quite literally, that he has this, like, fetish for a yellow, grayed out, washed out filter.
Yeah, totally.
This film is a little bit pissy looking. Like, don't you think?
It's a bit colourful.
It's a bit colourful, but it's still, this guy is not Scorsese. This guy is not, he's not interested in, like, big, lavish. The film is actually quite underdirected in a way.
Yeah.
It's, like, large, wide shots edited kind of in a slapdash manner. Like, it never draws attention to itself. It's not a showy film.
Right, yeah.
Which is weird, given that it's a film about
showiness.
Showiness. Yeah, being good at your job. Do you want to do the four-sentence game?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a way in which it could be quite easy for this film, right?
Because it's very confusing in the last act. But there's basically no first or second act.
Yeah, it's all final act.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's all first and final. So George Clooney is released from prison and wants to pull off... Danny Ocean, George Clooney, released from prison, wants to pull off one last job by... You never really find out. This I do some side...
Kind of like Dan's trying to explain why he's bad at the four sentence
game. No, I can do it more slickly, but maybe... But you never find out what George Clooney's life was before this, really. Like, he robbed things, he was a bad guy, very vaguely gestured towards.
It is, because doesn't his wife, Julia Roberts, break up with him because he was a thief?
A thief or I think maybe because he got caught, or, like, not, he was going to get out, but he stayed.
Yeah, I think maybe it's implied that he wasn't entirely forthright about being a thief.
Yes.
Which is a bad thing.
Which, yeah. Is
first rule of thievery.
Tell your wife.
Yeah. But is it implied that he's been lying for a long time? I can't tell. Like, is this a seasoned, hardened criminal who got caught and his wife is like, what the hell? Or was it just...
Well, it does say at the start when he's in the parole hearing, they say, like, and you've been connected to, like, 15 others or something. Yeah. So
I think that's important. I think he's both, and he knows all these people, right?
Yeah, sure.
Anyway, all right. I'll start again.
Go on.
George Clooney is released from prison, wants to pull off one final heist by stealing from the vault of some of the wealthiest casinos in Las Vegas, and pulls together a team of 11 people to do it.
Fantastic.
Nailed it. Like, yeah.
That's the first 40 first, minutes of this film.
Including, actually, is it a team? Is Ocean's 11 him plus 11 people or him plus 10 people?
Oof.
Oh, shit.
Because there's a lot.
No, I think he's included in the 11, yeah.
Because I haven't seen Ocean's 8, but isn't Ocean's 8, it's like, it's 8 famous people.
Yes.
Whereas, like, in Ocean's 11, there's a lot of people I do not know.
Right? Well, yeah.
Who's the guy who, like, argues with Casey Affleck all the time? Like,
yeah.
I didn't even realize that was Casey Affleck.
I wasn't, I mean, not at the same time, there is definitely quite a few.
There's a lot of big names.
Yeah.
A lot of stars. More than the average movie.
Totally.
Matt Damon just, like, pops up all of a sudden before you've even realized that, like, oh yeah, Matt Damon's in this movie.
He also doesn't really need to be in the film, actually. You could cut his character without any...
What's his character's arc?
He doesn't have one.
His arc?
Yeah. Like, isn't he someone's son?
He's someone's son. You never really learn, like, how...
Oh, yeah.
Like, how George Clooney knows his father. Mm. But it's implied that the father is, like, a master criminal or whatever as well.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, I totally agree that it's an entirely unnecessary role, but I find it really interesting to see Matt Damon play, like, a kind of, I don't know, like, a scrawny, insecure, like, he's a bit, you know? Yeah.
He's a dweeb.
He's a dweeb, yeah.
He's like discount Ben Affleck, which I think is what people thought of him at the time this film came out.
He has since bought a zoo.
That's true.
He started all sorts of...
He was in the green zone. You remember that movie?
I saw a preview of The Green Zone. I somehow came into tickets. That was like a...
Isn't that a film about the Iraq War?
Yeah. He's like, plays Jason Bourne. It's Jason Bourne goes to Iraq, basically. Yeah. I've got three more sentences.
God, you're roomy.
Brad Pitt, who is among the team, discovers that the casino, the person who owns the three casinos that they're going to rob, is in a relationship with George Clooney's wife. So that causes some tension within the team.
Easily the most problematic part of this film, right?
Oh, 100%.
I'm gonna steal the jewels and this woman who has no autonomy whatsoever.
Yeah, it's actually wild how underutilized she is as a character.
Yeah,
it's like, to a point, yeah, I think this is one of the things that I, like, learned when rewatching it. I was like, oh my god, she has, like, four lines.
Yeah.
Like, and just, like, yeah, is never shown as anything other than... I mean, at the end of the film, Brad Pitt literally says, like, I picked up your property or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a joke. And Pitt says, like, there's a women's prison down the road. Right. Maybe I'll pick up, like, my own partner. Fucking hell.
She also only ever, like, responds to stimulus. She never has any autonomy.
Right, yeah.
It's just, she's presented with things.
She is on the team in Ocean's 12, right?
Yes,
isn't she the
12th? I think that's true, yeah.
12th Ocean? Two more sentences.
I guess so. In order to pull off the heist, the Ocean's 11... I mean, I can't see, it would be, like, literally impossible to go through all the details, but they build a fake vault purportedly to practice on, and then go about, through a series of kind of cooperative manoeuvres, infiltrating the casino, seeming, and that's the third sentence, infiltrating the casino, and then...
a whimper of an ending.
Well, yeah, well, but then, because I'm almost at the end, right, and then, like... You think that they have struck a deal with the casino owner in order to take half the money and hold half it hostage and blowing it up and blow it up. And a SWAT team enters in order to discover the robbery, semicolon. It turns out that the...
That's a dodgy use of semicolon. Like a
comma then. It turns out... It's part of the same. It functions. And it turns out that in fact, they had replaced surveillance footage in the casino with video of the faked vault, which meant that when they pretended to be a SWAT team and entered the vault as the SWAT team and took the money then, after infiltrating it. I think that's what happens.
I don't really...
And then everyone escapes except George Clooney, who broke his parole, and then 6 months later, everything's fine, he gets out of prison, and Brad Pitt and Julia Roberts sail off into the distance. But pursued by two thuggish twins.
I don't get the heist. So they film it and they tell Andy Garcia, we've stolen half of your money.
Yeah.
If you come after us, we'll blow up the second half of the money.
That's right.
So Andy Garcia delivers them the second half of the money? No. What did the SWAT team get? I really couldn't understand.
Okay. So you get the... They intercept the 911 call.
Yes.
And they fake being the SWAT team.
Yes. Oh, so Garcia...
Andy Garcia is just like, I'll comply, but I don't know, I'm smarter than you, so I'll call a SWAT team and you'll get thwarted anyway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think the idea is that... Yeah, I mean, this is one of many things that doesn't really make sense, but, like, if the SWAT team goes after them, they still ostensibly could set off the hypothetical... booby trap, blowing up all the money. Oh, but then they do that anyway.
I think they couldn't access the vault properly, so that they...
So they need Garcia to open the vault for them.
Right, that's
so
true.
So they can come in as a SWAT team.
Yes.
And
yes.
They roll the grenade, so they, like, fake all the explosion stuff. I don't then understand why they need to sit... Like, I think there is some stuff that is wrong with this film. So, like, logically, obviously... Because a lot of it is played out with a set of the team. Like, as the team has done their jobs in order to infiltrate the casino, they are standing looking over surveillance footage, being very kind of tense about it. But you find out that all that footage, so particularly an acrobat who is employed to, like, jump around the vault without setting off the alarms, you find out that then that all happened in the fake vault.
Yeah.
Why are they tense about it? I think that's the problem with this film. Like, why aren't they just doing that 100 times? And they're like, great, good, we got it right.
But they blow up the doors so they can only do it once.
But I don't think they do. I think he opens it up. They come in as a SWAT team. They roll the grenades in to, like, put smoke everywhere. Because there's that scene you see of them shooting. We're going to get emails of people being like, you misunderstood Ocean's 11. But I think that's what happens. I think the way to access it is to trigger an emergency.
Yeah.
But then I don't know why they, like, was George Clooney just lying to everyone? But then they all must have known that it was going on in the fake vault because they built a fake vault inside their warehouse. By the way, the stuff that they do, including stealing an EMP from a, like, university.
Yes.
And constructing a fake vault, right. Definitely would, all this would at least cost $1 million. Yes. Everything they do. So they, like, whether, how they come across those funds. And they're supposed to, I guess they're supposed to get like $150 million.
But they get backed up by the, by Elliot Gould, right?
Yeah. I guess that's true.
Yeah. Elliot Gould. Elliot Gould is so good.
Really good in it, yeah.
He's also, I'm going to say it, Elliot Gould is maybe hot in this movie, I think.
Okay.
Hey, no! That sounds like judgment, Daniel.
Never.
I think he's wearing like an open dressing gown. He's got a cigar. That scene where he's like surrounded by kind of fruit and like he's got all his rings on. It's pretty hot, I'm sorry to say. I've always wanted to do a podcast, a movie podcast, which like, it's just two people not understanding, like, very famous twists.
Maybe this is the first episode. Yeah.
Can you imagine two people talking about Empire Strikes Back and being like, I just don't... his dad? Like, I don't... How does that... the funny thing that this film does... So I was thinking, I've been watching at the moment a lot of movies by David Mamet, the playwright and filmmaker, who makes movies about confidence men and tricks and kind of, and the thing that Mamet does that's really interesting is like Mamet tells you how the movie is going to go. Like the first 20 minutes of a movie like Heist is the characters being like, here is how we're going to pull off the heist, and they say exactly how they're going to pull off the heist, and then they pull off the heist and then it turns out that something's being withheld from you. This film does a different game where you don't really know how the heist is going to go down before it goes down. So it's like a very simple trick of withholding information.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's what makes it tense, is that, like, what are they going to do next?
It's just funny that you go into the heist as a viewer being like, okay, we're ready, it's heist time now, but you don't really know what's going to happen.
Even though you've had quite a lot of... You know that they need all these people with various skills, like Matt Damon is a pickpocket.
Yeah. Don Cheadle is blows shit up and has the world's least convincing...
God, it's so bad. Just, like, the worst accent.
He's trying to do... Do you think he's Do you think he's playing a character who wants to be Cockney and so is putting on a bad Cockney accent in the world of the film?
I don't think so.
I know, I can't say it.
That's too generous. Yeah.
I saw an interview that he'd done about where it was implied that his accent gets worse along the sequels.
Really?
By the interviewer or by him?
By both, kind of. And he sort of says, like, oh, I did all this work. Like, I went to London. I had conversations with people. Like, I tried so hard. Which is crazy because it's not even... It's like... People don't sound Cockney, really, anymore.
No.
Like,
no. True.
It's like Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins.
Yeah. Maybe worse. There's a bit where he's going, like... The joke is that nobody can understand what he's saying. So he goes, like, oh, we're in Barney trouble.
Barney.
And it's maybe worse than I just did it then. And I guess I am English. But, like, I did no research. I have not tried.
Mm.
It's maybe one of the worst on-screen accents.
Really bad.
And do you think you're Steven Soderbergh, you're a director, you rock up on set, you haven't, you know, pre-production has been long, you haven't really gotten time to talk to Don, and so you roll cameras and then Don's like, Barney trouble. what do you do? Is Steven Soderbergh too nice of a guy to be like, Don, we gotta cut this whole thing. Like, this is a mess.
Yeah, he doesn't need to be British. I guess they wanted a British lockpick, right? Because initially his job is, I think, being a lockbreaker.
Oh, is he?
And but then, because doesn't he come to them and he's like, I can't do it.
Oh,
we'll need an EMP.
Yeah, true.
Isn't he like munitions? Isn't he like...
Oh, maybe he's munitions.
Because he blows up a police car, as you say.
True. I wonder if he was tasked with that or he just kind of was like, you know what?
It is interesting that films that have a mass audience projected, like I think James Bond films in this, like films projected for mass audience... Mission Impossible as well. do not need the narrative to make sense. Like, you can make $1 billion and it does not need to make sense.
The Mission Impossible movies make a lot of sense.
Okay, sure.
I don't know what to say. I was thinking a lot. This film makes me think of the first Mission. Have you seen any of the Mission Impossibles?
I have, yes.
Maybe humankind's greatest work of art, I sometimes think. Like, fuck off, Sistine Chapel. Just give me the beginning bit of Fallout where, like, they trick the guy into giving them the codes by, like, faking being Wolf Blitzer, yeah, the Fox News guy. Maybe I've said this on the podcast, but my partner Brianna, who's been a guest on this podcast, her favorite thing in the world, the happiest I ever see her, is when she's watching a Mission Impossible movie and there's some mask shit. It blows her mind every time. At the end of one, someone puts on a mask and pretends to be Alec Baldwin, and she's like, this is it. She's all in for mask stuff. So I think if I made her watch Ocean's 11, she would be like,
not enough masks. Brad Pitt at the end tips up his SWAT team mask for in a casino floor where there would be cameras everywhere.
Yes.
Also, yeah, totally.
A mistake, Brad Pitt.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of... Yeah, they're quite flippant about all of that stuff. I mean, in the... I think about when, at the start, when George Clooney is telling Brad Pitt the plan... And they're just in, like, a crowded bar or something. Like, you really couldn't do that in, like, in the car that you're in or, like, any other place that someone in the table behind you might not be like, huh, crazy. Okay.
Yeah, those guys appear to be falling off.
If I didn't know any better, I would swear.
There's some kind of heist. But that is the thing, right? And I guess it goes back to the no violence thing, that this is ostensibly something of a fantasy movie.
Yeah, definitely.
It has, like, a... deliberately kind of like puff pastry feel and texture, to the extent that, like, things don't make sense.
Mm.
They're just going for easy quips rather than thought out stuff in a way that's, like, perfectly entertaining. Like, it works. It's a cohesive universe.
Sure. Yeah.
To the extent that, like, I think we're all talking about these quibbles in a way that implies that we know that, like, actually doesn't matter.
Oh yeah. It didn't cause me any trouble throughout the film. No, I'm not wait a second.
Yeah.
You're not interested in seeing, which is probably this film's greatest achievement, is you never worry about how coherent it is.
Yeah, totally.
I literally didn't know what was going on. I just sat there like...
But you know you know what the stakes are, right? Yes. It's like, will they rob the casino?
Yes.
So as long as you know that...
Kind of who gives a shit.
But then you also have to have the satisfaction of the twist, which maybe if you have no idea what's going on, but well, okay, gets a little less exciting. Totally. But I like it. I'd forgotten about that. I don't think I've seen it. Maybe I've seen it twice. I don't think I've seen it since I saw it at the cinema.
If the biggest criticism, I guess, I have of this film is, and I alluded to it before, I think George Clooney is not good in this film. Do you think...
That didn't occur to me.
I don't know
what you're talking
about. Know that I agree.
Like, he might not have been sparkling, but I thought he was fine.
I have the bias that, which is maybe like a more contentious bias, I don't think George Clooney is good looking.
That's insane.
Wow.
He's too perfectly good looking.
How can you think that about George Clooney and not Brad Pitt?
Brad Pitt is like a little bit more shit eater.
George Clooney can be. When he's got the tie around his neck, when he's coming out of the prison at the end.
I guess so. I just find him slick. I find him like a car salesman, George Clooney. The hotness ranking of our leads is probably Brad Pitt, extremely hot in this film. Elliot Gould.
No one in the world.
Who else is hot?
Matt Damon's always
I guess so.
Man.
I guess.
I mean, obviously Julia Roberts, right up there.
Andy Garcia. He's got good hair in this movie. Sure. He's well dressed.
Carl Reiner. R.I.P.
Very
recently.
I watched that. I watched this the night before. Woke up the next morning to Carl Reiner.
Wow.
Watched it Wednesday night. I must have. No, Tuesday night. And then Wednesday morning, I heard that Carl Reiner had passed, which is very sad.
Have you heard his tweet, like the all-time great Carl Reiner tweet about tweeting?
No.
I don't think so.
I have to find it. Carl Reiner, like, beloved comedy, like...
Luminary.
You know,
dad of Rob Reiner.
Mel Brooks collaborator.
And Wint-style Twitter legend, because where is it? I'm not going to be able to find it.
We can keep looking. We can come back to it. Okay. I mean, we should talk about Brad Pitt in this film as well. The topic of
that
the
would podcast. Seem appropriate. Yeah. Yes.
I mean,
I found it.
Okay, go.
He tweeted this year. I didn't realize it was so recently. Wow. He said, "For me, a tweetless night like tonight is an empty, ill-spent, fruitless night, not worthy of owning a computer or its keyboard."
What?
Very funny.
That's extremely drill.
It could be drill.
It's so drill.
It's incredibly drill.
I just retweeted it now. Truly a work of art.
That's wild.
That's crazy.
That man was like 98 when he tweeted that.
Yeah, and genuinely. Hilarious to the end.
Yeah, genuinely hilarious.
And he's funny. And as we haven't said, Ocean's 11 is funny. I think it's pretty funny.
I think it's pretty funny. Yeah.
There's some corny stuff in it. Yeah. But I think George Clooney is good. Brad Pitt is fantastic. So I saw this film at the cinema. I did not realize this until I was talking to my mother the other day. And she said, "Yeah, we saw it on my birthday." So I saw, I guess... We went to the cinema, and there's a couple of reasons. One reason I remember it is it was always very difficult to find a film Dad liked that was, like, out. It was a contemporary film, and I remember that he liked Ocean's 11.
Dan's dad is, like, a specter over this podcast.
In some ways.
Like, Dan is very critical of movies, and he thinks it's because it was, like, there's, like, a Freudian root cause.
Right.
Of, like,
I just think Dad taught me to be very critical of...
Trying to inhabit his dad's perspective when thinking about
a
movie.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because, I mean, I haven't asked him, but I could almost guarantee that Ocean's 11 is one of my dad's favorite movies.
Really?
Yeah, I bet. I think that if you were to get him on the podcast for this episode... I'm saying it's a fun movie, it's goofy, you know, it's like ridiculous and funny and whatever, and I think that my dad would be like, it's a good movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's art. Like,
yeah. Sure. The other parental thing I have about this film is that, so when I was talking to Mum the other day, I must have been halfway through the film, and I called my parents for whatever reason, and Mum was like, "Oh yeah, so she hasn't seen this in, what, 18 years? She was like, Brad Pitt plays the doctor." And I was like, "Excuse me?" I was like, "I don't think so." And she's like, "Yeah, with the hair and the glasses.
Oh,
he's a doctor."
Yeah,
I was like, "I don't know if that's true." And I went back to watch the movie. And there's like this 2-minute scene in which Brad Pitt wears this like crazy wig and these glasses and pretends to be a doctor.
Yeah.
And my mother remembered that 18 years later.
Is that all she remembered?
That's what
Ocean's
she said about Ocean's 11.
Is your mum like, "Ah, yes, Ocean's 11, the movie where Brad Pitt..."
That's literally what she said to me when I said I'm watching Ocean's 11.
Like, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah. Which I think speaks to the quality of Brad Pitt's performance in this film, if nothing else.
Definitely.
Brad Pitt is unbelievable in this film.
Very good.
He's like the heart and soul of this film for me.
And I think this is the iconic Brad Pitt that walks into people's heads if you say Brad Pitt to them.
Yes.
And I think...
He's chewing.
Yeah.
He's eating.
He's constantly eating.
Which he asked for, apparently. He was like, "I want to be eating in every scene in this film," which he doesn't quite get to, but a lot of lollipops.
Yeah.
He also, like, in the, like... final section of the film, he's eating while he's waiting for George, and he has like an acid reflux burn. Just like, Brad, you
like
have to
puts
go
his
that
fist
far.
On his chest.
Yeah, because didn't he say he wanted to eat in every scene because his vision for this character was like, this is a guy who has no time, so always has to be eating.
Well,
so maybe
funny.
The reflux burp is the added layer of like, he's always eating and it's causing him
digestive
issues.
And almost always standing while he's... Like, he's never seated at a table with a knife and fork. He's, like, holding his food.
Yeah.
I think for me, I do like this movie. I think this movie peaks early because I think for some reason, the scene that I really love is when you first meet the Pitt character, he is teaching celebrities how to play poker.
Fucking Topher Grace.
That is one of the most dated things about this
film. Absolutely.
That, like, the reference to celebrity is
Topher Grace.
Oh,
I didn't
Grace.
Pick up.
It's like Topher Grace, someone from Charmed, I think.
Is that right? It's so funny.
It's a real... Yeah, that dates the film more than anything, I think.
Yeah. Because you think Topher Grace is just playing anonymous celebrity, and then as he's leaving the bar, people are calling, like, "Topher, Topher."
Which, like... I can't, even at the height of his fame, Topher Grace isn't, like, getting mobbed by rabid fans. Like,
maybe, is Topher Grace in that 70s show?
Yeah.
So maybe that 70s show fans? Because what else, if you're like, I love Topher Grace movies, what are you talking about? Spider-Man 3?
Yeah, he's in Spider-Man 3, right? Yeah.
Like, what else? Ocean's 11. It did make... Have either of you seen Molly's Game?
I have.
Jessica?
No, yes.
Oh, because you
interviewed
Jessica
that's right. Yeah.
How crazy.
And she was real nice, wasn't she?
She was super nice, yeah. It was the first time when I've ever interviewed someone at the hotel they were staying at, I guess. And I as a neurotic person was really like, oh, I don't like what that's.
I don't like know in if, her room.
Yeah, oh. I was like, I don't know that I. Okay, sure. And I went in and she was like, she like, I think like popped off her shoes and like sat on the couch like a bit casual. And I was like, oh, okay, this is way. Yeah, I don't know. I think that maybe my theory about it is that I'd been waiting. I got to the hotel early and I was like, maybe if there were like five people interviewing her that day, four of those people were men,
mm-hmm.
and were, and I don't say this to like disparage anyone, especially not you guys, but they were like film
viewers. Men. Yes. Yeah. The film men.
Film enthusiasts. Like to the point where I think I spoke to the one guy and he was a bit, he was like, I think he was like maybe wearing a t-shirt that referenced another movie that Jessica Chastain had been.
Yes, yeah.
And he was like, I was just like, oh, I don't, cool, I guess.
Did he say like, do you think Jessica would wear this in a t-shirt?
He did. And I was like, oh yeah, maybe. I don't know. Very nice. Very nice person.
She seems lovely. She, every time she gets in trouble on social media, which is often these days, yes. I remember like, oh yeah, Alex said Jessica.
I didn't know that. Is she?
Yeah. I think. Yeah.
She sometimes is a little bit silly on Twitter.
Sure. Yeah.
Twitter is
all of us.
Just in, I think, the way that millionaires can be.
She's married to like a count as well, or something like. Like she's double millionaire. Yeah. You know, like. She's a member of some royal family.
Right, totally.
Why are we talking about Jessica?
Talking about Jessica Chastain?
Molly's Game?
That's right, you said. Molly's Game.
Molly's Game is... because that film is about celebrity poker games. And Michael Cera plays a character...
that's true.
...who's based on Tobey Maguire, apparently. Apparently, Tobey Maguire used to love going to high-stakes poker games and fucking with people.
Yeah.
And so maybe Topher Grace is like also a reference to that.
Spider-Man?
I guess so. Like, yeah, that dweeby American actor who like is not very... although apparently Maguire was good at poker.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Because that character in Molly's Game like ruins someone's life, right? Isn't there something quite...
like over a game of poker?
Yeah, he pushes that guy till he like has to mortgage his
house. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Michael Cera.
Yeah. Playing like a yeah. That's it's right. Aaron Sorkin. Which I guess is a thing to say that's positive about Ocean's 11.
Mm.
A way that it's different from someone like David Mamet and someone like Aaron Sorkin, who also make films about people who speak very fast and are very intelligent and are five steps ahead of the audience. Despite everything we said about the handling of the Julia Roberts character, this film is not necessarily like toxically male in the way that like an Aaron Sorkin vehicle often is.
That's true.
I guess it's because this is a fantasy.
I think maybe it doesn't. I think the way that it does that is that it doesn't ever have to like confront its like issues. It just kind of like exists in a world where they don't really cause any like that. Just doesn't really happen because it's so rooted in like male fantasy, whatever, like there's no women to like call them out on it, therefore it doesn't exist.
Well, it's almost like some of those, like the PG action film will incorporate what I think people don't talk enough about is kind of a male drama of sexlessness, like just not having the stakes of having to have a woman involved, you know, like the way she's involved is basically as
property
right? Totally. Like it's actually a pretty sexless film, and I think because of that, as you say, right, it's just not, it doesn't have to be confronted with the problems of toxic masculinity necessarily in any way more than like the cursory obvious ones.
Because George Clooney is angry that Julia Roberts is not with him anymore, but he doesn't appear to desire her.
He seems madder that she's dating Andy Garcia than he is desirous for her.
Yeah. I think to make a crude comparison, it's like she was stolen from me. So film, I'm going to do thievery on him.
Definitely. Yeah, the film trades in that vernacular 100%, that it's like a revenge heist. Which, yeah. I mean, if it's just like a simple tit for tat, couldn't you just steal like Andy Garcia's gold watch or something? Like, we don't need to be so highfalutin.
Well, we are like made to question the trade value of Julia Roberts again as well, because the thing that allows George Clooney to get her back is he sets up a surveillance camera so that when he confronts Andy Garcia, he says, Like, oh, by the way, yeah. if I were to give you... What is it? Like, if I were to find your money, if yeah. I were to give you back $160 million, would you leave yeah. Tess?
And
is, it, is that such a... That's such a stupid move the movie makes. But... And he says yes, and Julia Roberts sees this because she gets a phone call telling her to turn the television on to the yeah. channel that is playing that surveillance camera. And so the... The question is, like, this is how much she is worth to both these people, yeah. right?
And
like, which is a lot of money, but still.
I mean, the thing that makes all of this stuff go into even, like, cleaner focus, I think, is that all she has to hear is Andy Garcia saying, like, I would not give you up for $160 million. And she's like, right, Danny Ocean, he's the one for me.
Which is funny, yeah. because it's not that she just leaves Andy Garcia. No, she returns to Josh Clooney, who she has seemingly, for very good reasons, rejected.
Yes. I have to ask a question about a line in this film, which I think is a good line, but I also maybe don't get it a little bit. There's some back and forth with Brad Pitt where he suggests something outlandish and someone responds, are you suicidal? And Brad Pitt says, only in the mornings. Only in the mornings,
yeah.
Is this a flash of, like, true dark reality? Like, is he...
yeah.
What
I noticed this? That, but I've forgotten about it.
Mm.
Like, is this, like, what is that a reference to, if not, like, this guy is genuinely maybe very sad, like, really struggling.
It's interesting as well, because that's not a common thing, only being suicidal at one point of the day.
That's what I mean.
Like, yeah.
Unless I was
like
thinking...
he hasn't started drinking or doing whatever keeps him from...
Maybe the
wanting.
Idea is that he's having some kind of chemical hangover in the mornings.
That's oh, the he's drunk so much.
Right.
Oh, that might be it.
But he says the mornings. If he said, like, only on Saturday mornings,
yeah.
that would be an easy
quit. Like, every fucking morning, I am so suicidal.
Yeah.
You would not believe.
By 3 p.m. though.
Yeah. And he delivers it with, like, a smile. Like, it's incongruous with the language of this film that Brad Pitt's just like, yeah, you know, life's a drag.
I don't know if there's any other contemporary actor who could pull that line off in the same way.
No.
Yeah, totally.
Because he's so much fun in this movie.
But also because he has that undercurrent of seriousness or that irony or something, which I think he has here.
Brad Pitt, the best actor. It's interesting.
Very good actor.
It's interesting to do this the way that we've done it, that, like, Dan and I kept watching crazy movies like The Dark Side of the Sun that, like, no one's seen.
Sure.
And being like, where is Brad Pitt? Like, where is the Brad Pitt that people think they know?
Yeah.
And it's here.
Yeah.
This is charming, likable,
yeah.
funny, kind of zany, slightly hangdog Brad Pitt.
More than Seven, more than Fight Club.
Yeah. Here
totally.
It is.
It's interesting because, like, at once it's like he almost seems, like, apathetic about the idea of doing it. I think like the, like, standing against the wall and, like, eating a sandwich and being like, yep, okay, let's do it. Like, it's kind of, I think it's an interesting foil to George Clooney's, like, George Clooney plays it quite cool, but is also clearly very invested in
mm-hmm.
it,
mm-hmm.
which I don't, like, Brad Pitt doesn't seem as invested in it. Like, obviously he wants it to go well, but yeah, I don't know. Most of the he kind of seems a bit like, I think, which I don't know, maybe that's part of the, like, I'm only suicidal. Because it does, I mean, when it starts off, he is clearly, you know, he's, like, teaching actors how to play. Like, it doesn't seem like he's killing it, you know? Like,
right. Yeah.
He says, I'm so bored.
Yeah,
at
totally.
The beginning of the film. He seems like a character who is interested in the heist, not for the money, but for, like, the thrill of
totally.
It, I guess. Which is why, also, I think, related to what you're saying about him versus Clooney, is, like, Clooney is the comedic straight man. And Brad Pitt is the zany... I don't know, I've never actually seen any Laurel and Hardy, so whichever's the zany one, that's Brad Pitt too. Do you know?
I've seen a bunch, but I actually forget which is which. I think Laurel's the skinny one.
Okay, and he's the serious one?
No, he's the jokey one.
Oh.
I think... I don't know. I used to watch those a bunch. They're not very funny.
No,
they're violent. Like they're sad. Funny. They're really sad.
Yeah,
upsetting.
It's what... That's
bad things
what,
happening to poor people mostly. Like cops just getting in the way.
That's what happened in the 50s, like your comedy was set. You
I
sat
think,
in
I think it's like the 20s and 30s. Like it's even worse. It's just everyone's getting holes in their hats.
People are
God.
Pulling down the canvas in front of shop fronts. It's got water on everyone.
You're walking around a corner, you're getting hit by a plank.
It was rough times for everyone. What else is there to say about this film? Do you all have any, like,
words? I love Las Vegas. Have either of you been to Vegas?
No.
I've never
it's
been.
It's the weirdest place.
It seems weird. My mum went for 48 hours to accompany my dad on a work trip and got extremely sick. And so her only knowledge of Vegas is, like, the inside of Vegas casinos and, like, puking a lot.
That makes... Yeah. That's, like, the... I would say that's probably the ultimate Las Vegas experience. Yeah. I would say that is... That is the best understanding of what Las Vegas is. It smells... Because the distinguishing things about it... It's, I guess... I've never been to Disneyland and I've never been on a cruise ship, but my sense is it is exactly like both those things.
Right.
It's just like... It smells... I guess it's because I was staying in the Flamingo, but it smells pink. There's something about... And I've smelt it in RSLs as well. Yeah. I think the reason they do it is because when people are smoking indoors, there's like something they've got to put into the air. You've got to have very high strength air conditioning and you've got to put something into the air to like neutralize totally. The... Nicotine.
Well, in Sydney casinos, they pump the air with lemon zest scent because it keeps people awake.
That is probably something like that.
And that's why it's very cold, too. Very cold. You can't really see a clock, although you legally have to be in some kind of closeness to a clock so you know what time it is. But, like, no windows.
Yeah. You don't... Mm-hmm. Everything's very... But it's just... everyone's sad as well. Like, no one looks happy to be there. But... It's just so, like, there's this weird, you wouldn't want to be there for more than 48 hours. I think I was only there for a couple of days, but it's just, there's this sense of, it's totally fascinating.
And it's in the middle of the desert.
And it's like, and you fly in and then there's this, like, you just see the casinos in the middle of the desert. But I think my favorite thing about the new season, well, not my favorite thing, I think that really thrilled me about the new season of Twin Peaks, along with all of it, was that when I remember when it like went to Vegas, I was just so happy. Because that, like, there's something about the aesthetic of Las Vegas. Yeah. That I find so energizing and endlessly fascinating. I could just stare at a row of slot machines forever. Because also, it's literally supposed to be hypnotic. Mm. It's a shame that Soderbergh doesn't make more of that stuff, but totally. I think Vegas still... It's still interesting in the film, but it could be so much more.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's interesting because... I don't know, I think Vegas is interesting because it at once is like an obvious anomaly. There aren't many other places in the middle of the desert like that. But it also... like, is not an anomaly in that it reproduces and amplifies most of what is terrible about, you know, capitalism and predatory and all that stuff.
And America.
Like, and America, totally. Yeah.
American version of capitalism.
But you also see it, like, every slot machine floor, every, like, VIP room in a pub or an RSL, every, you know, Dubai... casino, it's all just copies of Vegas. Yeah. So Vegas is like, has all these copies of things, like the weird little Eiffel Tower, and like everything is like the Venice, is the Bellagio supposed to be like Venice, I think, parts of it. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's all these simulacra of stuff, but then it somehow gets associated with this wealth and luxury, which it just is like an extremely unappealing version of, obviously. Mm. But that just gets replicated everywhere. Like that becomes the signifier, which is the copy of something else.
Yeah,
it's just totally. It's just so weird. And it's kind of fun as well. Like, it's genuinely fun to look at. I mean, anyway, I'm fascinated by Las Vegas.
What are the good Vegas movies?
Casino. Oh, no, Casino's in... Isn't Casino set in, like, Reno or something?
I think is. This is a Casino Vegas movie. Also, Mars Attacks. Have either of you seen Mars Attacks?
No.
Maybe one of humanity's greatest achievements as well. The Tim Burton movie about, like, aliens invading with, like, big heads, big grey heads.
That's also a film with a blockbuster cast.
Incredible. Danny DeVito's in that movie for 2 minutes. Jack Nicholson plays, like, three different people. The final shot is Tom Jones singing to a dove that's landed on his arm.
Oh, my God.
Perfect, perfect movie. Highly recommend it. Yeah, it's interesting that this film... the tightrope walk that it does manage is that it is clearly Vegas, but it's not a Vegas in any of the way that either of you have just described, right? Yeah. Like, it's not predatory, it's not capitalistic, it looks kind of nice. It buys almost into the myth of Vegas as Vegas tells itself.
Big playground.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's handsome.
Yeah. There are these flashbacks to prior attempts to rip off casinos, and they're kind of like light and fun.
Yeah. It does these like black and white flashbacks. Yeah, that's interesting. Like, it buys into its own mythology.
But you felt you didn't like this movie as much this time.
I didn't like it as much.
How long since you'd seen it, do you think?
Maybe like 5 years, yeah. I would say. Yeah, I definitely didn't like it as much, but I think part of that I think part of that... I mean, I watched it twice to prepare for this. And I think the first time I was more aware... Like, I picked up on, like, obvious, like, inconsistencies and, like, loopholes and stuff. And was like, this is... Like, it barely held together. Like, how does this... And then I think the second time I watched it, I just was like, I'm not gonna think about any of that.
Yeah.
And just watched it and enjoyed it a lot more.
Did you watch it alone both times? Because I feel like it's a film that plays well when you're surrounded by other people. He says, having watched the movie. I watched it alone as well.
Yeah, no. I watched it alone both times for this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I probably would have... watched it. Like I said, it's kind of the movie that my dad really loves. So I assume that I would have watched it with my father at some point.
It's a film for dads.
It's a huge dad film.
It's also not, if I were to say, dad movie, I don't think Ocean's 11 is what you think of immediately.
No.
Why is it a dad movie?
I mean, we didn't say, but it is a remake of, like, Pack film.
Oh, yeah. I keep meaning to bring that up. Has anyone... I haven't seen
it.
Frank Sinatra and...
Tried to watch... I couldn't find, like, a full version of it, but I tried... I watched some clips of it on YouTube, and maybe this is just because I couldn't see the whole thing, but based on the clips that I saw of the original 1960 Ocean's 11... I was like, these are almost entire... Like, there is seemingly no correlation between these two films other than the fact that they rob casinos.
Yeah.
And I guess star a bunch of already famous
actors. Well, yeah, that as well, totally. Yeah, like, from what I remember, the 1961 has them hit, I think, 5 different casinos, sort of one after the other.
See, I like that idea.
Yeah, totally. That
not
seems...
taking revenge as well, presumably, for the stealing of someone's wife, maybe.
I mean, things were very... I'm
sure, but I mean, like...
Sure.
If you're hitting 5 different casinos.
That's true.
Unless it's, like, 5 wife guys who are all getting revenge. Yeah.
11
wives. No, from what I could tell, the plot's central tension comes from another... There's another more established robber, and he comes and meets them after they, I guess, have done a heist or two, and is like, give me some of the money that you've stolen, or I'll rat you out, think is the deal. And then, I'm not sure, because again, I only saw small snippets, but I think what happens is that they don't agree to do that, and then he plots to thwart them.
Somehow. So there's still, like, an antagonist.
Yeah, definitely.
Cinema. So, I mean, I don't know anything about how studios work, but I wonder, like, the Ocean's 11 name in, like, because the original Ocean's 11 being a Rat Pack film, it seems like the new Ocean's 11, to some extent, is an attempt to canonize a set of actors and their value.
Yeah,
for sure.
So we're saying, like, these are the guys who you will come and see in films. We are making them big deals.
Yeah.
And this is... both, like, the marquee of this film of stars is very impressive, but then, like, amplifying these stars as property, like, increasing their value.
Yeah. A thing that definitely, that I don't know went on behind the scenes of this film, but I also do know, there is someone, they're probably listed as, like, an associate producer, or maybe they got a story credit, who was in a studio, worked in a studio, and said to someone, we should remake Ocean's 11, but we should make it, like, fun, and Brad Pitt should be in it. And that person made, like, $20 million off this film.
Sure.
Like, there's just some guy probably doing a lot of blow, like, horrible to be in a room with, who was just like, you know what? You could make a movie and it could be, like,
they're
fun.
Like, they're like Frank Sinatra. And it's like the worst people in the world who think that is an aesthetic to mimic.
But
this works. But this doesn't feel... It's a sleazy film in a number of ways, but it doesn't feel sleazy.
No, it doesn't. Soderbergh does it. He is self-referentially chameleonic. Like, each film, he'll try different things. He does a good job of inhabiting, like, 60s fun crime caper in this movie as a director without being, like... If you made this film today, maybe you would, like, do the... self-conscious thing of, oh, you can't even tell what time period it's set in. Like, this film is clearly set in 2001. For He's sure. not being anachronistic.
That's true.
But he is inhabiting, like, a way of making movies that people don't use anymore. I think we have to, maybe almost in summation before we move to Letterboxd Game, have to talk about the scene that I think everyone thinks is the best scene of this film, which is the genuinely reasonably moving Clair de Lune fountain scene.
Yes.
Where you pan across them and they've succeeded, Clair de Lune plays, and they kind of don't say anything and they part. And it's... that's the Soderbergh filmmaker who I don't like, maybe. That's the genius touch of like...
Mm.
You could so easily have, like, you know, everyone laughing at each other in the car, or like, some, you know, everyone's looking at each other, or they're sharing a joke, or... And instead, that Clair de Lune scene is almost melancholy.
Yeah.
Like, they don't look at each other. The music is beautiful. Yeah. And they just scatter.
I think it's... Even though, as you say, they don't really look at each other or whatever, it's... Yeah, it's an unexpected, like, emotional way. You're like, oh. Which is interesting. Like, I've been thinking a lot about the... I know you guys haven't seen it, but Ocean's 8, there's a lot of, or at least a lot more focus on, like, the relationships that they form with one another. Whereas in Ocean's 11, up until that point, pretty much, it's almost like...
That is Ida, that is not one of us.
Ida making horrendous cough. It's not your walk time, it's 4:20, dude, blaze it. You're not walking for another 40 minutes. What is she doing? Go on, sorry. Yeah, they have almost no interpersonal relationships,
yeah,
to the team.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I haven't seen Ocean's 8, but do they have character arcs? Because no one... Like, Joe, you mentioned one character. Like, Matt Damon's character doesn't really have an arc, but I don't know if any of them do, really. I mean, Clooney's out of prison, back in prison, free.
Brad Pitt was bored, now he's not
less
bored
anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, there's not complicated character stuff at all.
Yeah, they don't really do that for a lot of characters in Ocean's 8, apart from Sandra Bullock, who... Because the way that Ocean's 8 ties into Ocean's 11 is that Sandra Bullock is George Clooney's sister.
Oh, Ocean, because your last name. Okay,
right,
okay.
Yeah.
Is Clooney in Ocean's 8?
So, no, he's dead.
Oh!
Spoiler alert.
George Clooney is...
They kill him?
Does he die in Ocean's 13?
Well, that's what I thought. But no, he's dead without any explanation. Like, the first instance that you know about that is that Sandra Bullock gets out of prison, because it has the same, she has parole, and then immediately goes and visits, George Clooney's character's grave. And it's very odd if you don't, like, it's a bit, I don't know, because I remember when I first saw Ocean's 8, and I... saw that scene, and I was like, was he killed at the end of Ocean's 13? But I don't think he is. I don't think it's ever explained, apart from when she goes and visits the grave, Elliot Gould.
Really?
Comes and visits her.
What?
And it's, like, implied that they have a... like, that they know each other, they have a history.
It was Clooney too expensive? Was he like, I'm not going to be in this film unless you pay me, like, $20 million? And they were like, we don't have the budget for Ocean's 8. Because we've got to play Sandra Bullock and Cate Blanchett. But, like, the killing of a... Sometimes movies do that, right? They, like, kill a beloved character off-screen. The one I think about is... Have either of you all seen Aliens and Alien 3?
No.
Two great films.
I've not.
Aliens ends with Ripley, the main character of the franchise, like... making a kind of substitute family. She meets a young girl called Newt, and she kind of... falls in love, and it's really hard won, and it really works, and you really love them. And Aliens ends with Ripley and her kind of new adopted daughter and a husband all going into cryopods, like going out into the world. Who knows what their next adventure will be? Alien 3 starts, and Newt and her husband are dead. They're just dead.
God.
They're like, they died. They died in hypersleep. That's it. Like,
wow.
Like,
Ocean's 8 has... There's, like, an undercurrent of, like, is he really dead, though?
Okay. Sure, like, yeah, he's gonna, like, spring out from behind.
Pretty much all the time. Because she goes and visits his grave quite a lot. And I think at the start, she says, like, you better be in there. Like, you better actually be dead or something. And then you hear a cough. And it turns out to be Elliot Gould.
Okay.
So,
maybe they had to rewrite the end of the script after Clooney could, like, his schedule messed up. Because it's such a weird bait and switch if you're like, yeah, totally. Oh, maybe he's there. It's like, no, he's actually George Clooney. Yeah. He's dead.
Yeah, 100%.
Going back to his home planet.
Dead. Should we play the letterbox game? I have to take this dog out for a week.
Sure.
And then we can let's have a brief pause.
Do you want to weigh on mic?
Is that anti-ASMR?
We should see if we can find out the Damien Didjerigbe reviews as well, if you can find
them. You'll see them straight away. Oh, okay. There's like five of them, and they're... Yeah, like two of them are in the immediate five, and then the rest are from there. My favorite one is that he talks about how... And this is something I hadn't thought about, and then it blew me away when I realized it. Ocean's 11, led by George Clooney, heist movie. Wes Anderson's Fantastic Mr. Fox. Heist movie. Led by George Clooney.
Of course.
Shit. Fantastic Mr. Fox, probably Wes Anderson's best film, right?
I would say so. Yeah.
But definitely it's his most, like...
I love that faultless. Film. Really, really love that.
It's like, I love Rushmore, but... Rushmore has its problems.
Yeah.
The first 2 minutes of Fantastic Mr. Fox where he gets trapped and he's, like, trying out his...
Yeah.
Like, it's just...
It's gold.
Yeah. It's all gold. Before we quickly do the letterbox game, actually, is Ida being naughty? No, she's... Yes, she is. What are you doing? I'm talking to you. What are you doing? Oh, shit. You're fine. You're a good girl. Just don't mess with your bed. That's what I thought. we did not say an excellent performance in this film. Bernie Mac.
Oh, of course.
So good. So effortlessly charming.
Yeah.
Kind of underused. He's not in the film a lot.
No.
I'm not even... Like, his role even... He's kind of underused in the heist as well. Yeah. His role isn't exactly clear. Yeah, he's to get into trouble so that Matt Damon can... I can't be bothered explaining it.
His role is mostly pre-production, right?
He's getting
the plans and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think the scene where he... goes off on Matt Damon and calls him a racist and stuff is great.
Yeah, he's good. He's funny. He's like, him and Brad Pitt are probably the funniest people in this film.
He's in 12 and 13.
Oh.
So is the 12th the person added is Julia Roberts?
It must be.
Is the 13th person added Andy Garcia? Isn't that the joke, right? That Garcia comes back and he's like a goodie. They need him for some reason.
Yes.
We'll find out.
Yeah.
episode whatever true, of the Brad Pitt cast.
Yeah.
Another thing to say about Bernie Mac, obviously, like, sadly departed. Fantastic.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, 2008. So he passed away. Genuinely sad.
Yeah, I remember that.
We would get to talk about Bernie Mac again if we did. So after the Brad Pitt cast, Alex, I'm trying to bully Dan into doing the Cameron Diaz podcast.
Wow.
And Bernie Mac is in... Charlie's Angels, Full Throttle.
Okay.
A classic.
Sure. A true classic of the genre. Talk about... Actually, is Charlie's Angels kind of equivalent to Ocean's 11? A little bit, maybe. Big stars, kind of old-timey reboot, kind of cute and fluffy. But Charlie's Angels is much hornier.
And I mean, Charlie's Angels, like, the reboot is still very, like, male-gazy. The first Letterboxd review for this is incredible.
What's that? Go on.
So it's someone whose username is Brat Pitt.
Yeah.
Have you encountered this person before?
So they are a massive Letterboxd user. They have a massive Twitter following, and they are a Brad Pitt stan.
I see.
But I don't think they've ever actually come up.
Oh, I see. Because the reviews go by how much they're liked.
Yes. Her top four films are the first Kill Bill. Have you seen the first Kill Bill?
I have.
Do you like it?
Yeah.
Yeah, better than the second. I like the second better. Second is sadder, slower.
Yeah.
Second has the, like, Bill Bride
confrontation,
which I think is great.
Yeah, actually, I think maybe the second, I think, is, like, a better film or whatever.
First one's just weird. You haven't seen either Kill Bill.
I've seen the first half of the first one.
Oh, Dan, get out of here.
Yeah.
Other three, one of Dan's favourite films of all time, Mulholland Drive.
Great film.
Yeah. Do you like Mulholland Drive?
Yeah, absolutely.
Masterpiece.
Mikey and Nikki, have you seen that film, Alex?
No.
Is that also on there? Oh, yeah. Great. Good film, yeah. Great film. It's a very upsetting.
But in a good way.
I guess so. It really shook me up.
I know it did. You were real upset by it.
Exactly.
But that, damn.
Yeah, it's a good film. It's obviously, yeah, a great film.
John Cassavetes.
Yeah, John Cassavetes.
Yeah.
He's talking about hot. John Cassavetes, so in that
movie. Peter Falker, unbelievable in that movie.
Yeah, all-time great performances from both of them. And Thelma and Louise.
Which, oh, that's something. So when I watched Ocean's 11, I was like, I think this is the Brad Pitt film I like the most that we've watched so far.
Is that right?
Yeah. I think this is the first one that I would be like, oh yeah, fun film. Like, uncomplicatedly.
But cinema shouldn't be defined by, like, fun.
Oh, but no, but, like, it's not a great film. It's just, like, that's the, like, if we're going up the ladder. I would recommend this probably more than any other film we've seen. Mm. Almost certainly. 1000%. Like, unquestionably.
Seven is an obvious masterpiece to me.
That's just not at all the case for me. But...
Do you like Seven?
I do, yeah.
It's good. I like Seven. I just don't. I think it's got some real issues. I mean, it's like, too... It's too corny or something. But anyway, I was like, what? Because I don't think it's that I don't like movies. I think it's just that I just generally align with common consensus. And so I looked up the Metacritic scores of all Brad Pitt's films. And this Ocean's 11 is significantly the highest rated film in his career so far, except Thelma and Louise.
Right.
So Thelma and Louise is like 80-something on Metacritic. Ocean's 11 is like 70-something. And the highest he gets before that is like 64,
65. Oh, so far. Not
full stop. Yeah. So of the films you've watched so far. Oh, right. Sure. And then, like, in the second half of his career, it goes nuts.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, like, Moneyball and Tree of Life.
Exactly. Must have, like, 98%. They're both beloved. Yeah. And I'm not saying that I agree with all those numbers or anything, but I was just like, oh, yeah, that makes sense to me.
Brad Pitt's review, which, as you say, is great, is here's a list of food Brad Pitt eats in the best male fantasy of all time, trademark, aka Ocean's 11, 2001. Please let me know if I missed anything. It was very hard to keep track. Nachos? I don't remember. When does he eat nachos?
That's right at the start.
At the pub?
No, isn't he eating them at the... Don't they meet and he's like...
Oh, sitting on the car or whatever?
Yeah.
Salad times two.
Yes.
Does he eat salad in the bar? Bar. Pub salad would be a kind of rough
proposition. I'm not sure. I can't remember him eating salad. Oh, he eats salad when they meet with Elliot Gould.
That's right, of course. Yeah. Cotton candy, fruit cup, assorted party snacks times two, lollipop.
Yeah, I love the lollipop.
Yeah,
shrimp cocktail, ice cream. Ice cream is great.
When's he eating ice cream?
Yeah.
Isn't it, because it's like dripping over his hands, I seem to remember. Mm. It's like during the heist. Maybe that's not right. I have visceral memories. And burger, which is what he's eating at the end when he gets bad reflux. shall we do three other Letterboxd reviews? Shall we do someone who's given the film a real low rating and someone's given the film a real high rating?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Definitely.
Should we do someone who's given this film half a star?
I want to see that.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, here's a good review that this person doesn't have a top four film, so I'll just blast through it. Where were these guys when my mum confiscated my Game Boy?
That's pretty good. That's funny.
That's good, yeah.
Oh, yeah. See, you encounter a lot of these, like... You encounter quite a lot of this on Letterboxd. So here's a person... I actually won't give their username, but the top films are Annihilation. Have you seen Annihilation?
No.
I like Annihilation.
It's pretty good.
Good soundtrack.
It's based on the Jeff Vandermeer book. It's like a sci-fi.
Okay.
It's actually really good. It's on Netflix.
Dope.
Under the Skin. Have you seen that one? Scarlett Johansson, sci-fi.
Masterpiece.
Oh, yes, I have seen that. I did.
Unbelievable. Ex Machina, which is the one where Oscar Isaac does the cool dance. And he plays... It's like a Frankenstein riff. It's good. It's also good. It's about a robot. A scientist builds a robot and they do like Turing test stuff with it.
Right.
And then someone has sex with the robot. It's a lot. Interstellar, which is... You haven't seen Interstellar?
No.
Maybe you would like it. It kind of loses the plot a little bit in its last 20 minutes.
Okay.
Like, Matthew McConaughey goes, like, spiraling through space and just happens to get picked up by, like, a spaceship while he's, like, flying through the vast recesses of space. Anyway, this person's review is...
How many stars? Is this half a star?
This is half a star.
Okay.
This was fucking garbage. Literally, what was even happening? I hate men so much, it's unreal.
Sure.
So, let me find one more half a star so I can just, like...
I don't think of this... We've called it a dad film.
Mm.
It's misogynist. I don't think of it as a super male film, but maybe that's wrong.
I think it doesn't feel very masculine. Fluffy, like divorced from the real world.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think it's like, in the sense that, like, I don't know. I think maybe what it is partially is that any problem they encounter, they're like smart enough or like charismatic enough to like figure their way out of. Yeah,
that's true. That's, yeah, of course.
This person, I won't read their top four films, but their review is, okay, cool, there's like a dozen of you stealing shit. Do it alone next time if you want to impress me. It's really funny.
I can't even really think of other films I like where, like, that are around stealing a thing.
That is true, yeah.
Wallace and Gromit and The Wrong Trousers.
True. Wallace and Gromit. Quite a lot of stealing in Wallace and Gromit, generally. the David Mamet movies that I love. He made lots of movies about
stealing. Right.
So House of Cards, his first film, which is a masterpiece, is all about stealing and confidence, man. In fact, I was going to do this before. Maybe I'll just quickly read it now that before we turn to the Letterboxd game. I know we're running out of time. So Mamet is the dad of Zsozsa Mamet from Girls. And Mamet, like, acclaimed screenwriter, very famous. You bring in, and a playwright, very famous playwright.
I've never made that connection. That's wild.
Mm. So Mamet was left wing for a long time, and then in the early 2000s, decided to become a conservative.
He wrote a book about it.
He did.
Wow. Okay.
I think he's explained it as being like the gateway drug was feeling like the left was, quote-unquote, soft on Israel, and then coming in from being, like, a Zionist into becoming a full-blown conservative. But he's been quite quiet about it, so I was always like, is he one of those guys who kind of had this conservative outburst and then kind of settled back down? Mm. A bit like Frank Miller, the comic book author. He was, super racist around 9/11, and then he calmed down a bit. So I googled recently to find out, because I also thought, like, oh, his daughter is on Girls, like, not that you want to equate someone's politics with their parents' politics, but in trying to find out if David Mamet was still a conservative, I found this article, January 24th of this year, an interview with David Mamet on Breitbart. So already we're having some questions answered. Okay,
sure, yeah.
David Mamet: Trump is a great president. Left's reaction has been psychotic. And then I tried to find the quote. So this is David Mamet on Trump. It's very short. The reaction to Trump to me is fascinating. And one day I started looking at it and squinted my eyes. If you take a Freudian analytical concept, turn it inside out, flip cause and effect, and see if the dream makes sense. So if we flip cause and effect, the reaction to Trump, which is psychotic, is equal, I believe, hydraulically, to the reaction to a charismatic leader. Now, what the fuck does any of that mean?
That's very funny.
Hydraulically.
I don't know why hydraulically. I guess...
What's the... You flip cause and effect. So you don't flip cause and effect. He means inverse reaction to something.
Yeah.
What the fuck does that have to do with Freud?
Nothing.
What does that have to do with dreams?
Nothing. I mean, I think what he's saying is the father figure... Like, hate and love for the father figure. Like, a charismatic leader is generally someone to get obsessed with. People are obsessed with Trump, but in fact, their obsession with him manifests in hate as opposed to love.
Oh, sure. Right.
That's the point.
But do you think...
But it's also... Which is all actually also kind of true when you see the way in which some... Hey, guys, I'm pro-Trump.
Is this the time to reveal?
Which is like the way some liberals get obsessed with, you know, obsessed over Trump.
Sure. It's kind of Freudian. Do you think David does that interview and then, like, Zsozsa calls him and is like, Dad, you are hurting my career. Like, although hopefully no one would take it out.
I don't know a ton about her outside of being on Girls, but I mean, do you think someone who watches Girls is like, that is David Mamet's daughter.
So time to find out what David Mamet thinks.
Yeah.
Also, I think it's possible that I'm, like, being overly generous to the idea that, like, if you're on Girls, that means that you're definitely on the list.
I was going to say,
Oscar Isaac is in that show, and didn't he join the military to get revenge for 9/11?
No, that, Adam Driver.
Adam Driver.
That's
who
true.
Did I say?
Don't slander Oscar Isaac.
Oscar Isaac.
Yeah, although he's... Yeah, he's there's a long New York profile about him where he kind of... It sounds less insane in context, but it's still a pretty insane thing. He's also very young.
I want to get revenge.
Definitely not good to join the military.
So let's do one more half a star review of Ocean's 11 and then finish ourselves with like a full 5-star.
Yeah.
So this person is who's given a half star. Their top 4 favorite films are The Incredibles. Have you seen The Incredibles?
I must have, yeah.
Have you heard those people who think that it's like a libertarian Ayn Rand fantasy about exceptionalism?
Oh my god, what?
Like, let great people be great.
Because then they'll, like, do these amazing things.
Yeah. Because the villain of that film wants to make everyone great. And the argument is like, and then no one will be great.
Oh my god.
It is a bit Randian.
Isn't
one of the guys at Pixar a libertarian?
I mean, Brad Bird, who directed this film, people have always said, is he a libertarian? Because he also made Tomorrowland with George Clooney, which is like, the great artists should live in a society. And like, he says no. But I mean, you can be wrong about the things that you think.
Sure,
wait, this person's like number one film is The Incredibles?
So their top 4 films, they haven't ranked it, but The Incredibles is on there. So is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
I like that
great
film.
Great movie, yeah.
Yeah.
So is La La Land.
Haven't seen it.
I do not like that film. And most surprisingly of all, the fourth one is Love, Simon. Have you seen that film?
I don't. What I know about it is that it's like a... I don't know. Is it like a gay coming of age?
It's like queer rom-com.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. That's right.
But I've seen that film and like... Its politics are bad.
I've heard that.
It's hateful.
Yeah, I have heard that it's not a particular... Because from what I remember, and I could be wrong, but I don't think like the writer or director or anything were queer.
No, the lead actor, which I mean is a conversation, is not queer either.
Sure.
Like it's... Yeah, that film pivots on the plot point that he is anonymously messaging someone... And a third party finds the emails, realizes that he's gay, and then uses that to get him to do stuff for him. So basically a hate crime, like blackmails, threatens to out him.
But the film doesn't endorse that point of view, I don't imagine.
But the guy who does the blackmailing is like, dweeby kind of fun, cool guy.
Oh, right. He's not like blackmailing him to go and like do anything intense.
No,
like,
he's blackmailing... Simon, our main character, to help him get a date. So the film is kind of
like
frothy about
it. Yeah, kind of a John Hughes-y.
Very, very problematic, that film. I think it's one of the worst films I've ever seen. I gave it a single star, apparently, according to Letterboxd. This person's review of Ocean's 11. Ocean's 11 is not good. So, you know, right to the point. The plot makes no sense because they don't explain anything. Because they couldn't figure out how to make it make sense. So that's a value judgment. That like, there's just a series of things that they have to do for some reason. And then they
that's what a movie is.
Yeah, exactly. And then they do them, and we're supposed to believe that the plan somehow works. This movie is really boring. I don't know why anyone would watch it.
That's interesting. This person has some problems with... understanding the boundaries between their own mind and those of others, I think. No empathy.
In the history of gross lines about women, you can't split Tess 11 ways is an all-timer, says this person. So, like, that's a...
Yeah,
like,
that's a pretty
accurate.
Valid
criticism.
Yeah.
Although, yeah, I'm not going to defend that line as such, but at least that film... Maybe that line is at least commenting on the way in which the film was treating her.
Yeah, definitely.
But the film doesn't redeem itself.
No, in respect to that. It's not enough of a distinction to be like...
awareness. Totally.
I'll just speed through some quickly and then I'll read a proper 5-star. This person just says, Ocean's 11 is awesome and I love it. The cast, story, directing, all of it.
I love
that's
that.
My favorite kind of movie.
You love movies.
Where you're just like, hey.
Keep watching movies.
Yeah. The camera, they move the camera. Is it perfect? Yes. Is it my favorite movie? Also yes. That's great.
Wow. I feel like that's one of the few times that someone's like asked the rhetorical of like, is it perfect? And they're like, yes, it is.
Yeah.
Is it a perfect movie? Yeah, absolutely it is.
Not a 4. Any scene starts, me, God, this part's great. I mean, like, that's someone's review. That's like... So that's a person commenting on the fact that this film is like a string of enjoyable set pieces.
Sure.
It keeps moving.
My mum's favourite movie, says this person.
Good on you.
No, just a dad's.
No mum's allowed. Okay, let me find a proper one. The only bad thing about this movie is Don Cheadle's accent.
Yes, but also, if you just think of it as like something fun and dumb, you're like, exactly. Oh, this is great.
Yeah, if you made this movie on its own terms...
It's a terrible accent, but not in a way that distracts at all.
That's true, because the film's supposed to be kind of cool and neat, right?
Mm.
It makes me think that, like... Have you seen the Michelle Gondry Green Hornet film with Seth Rogen?
No.
It came out when I was like 16, I think. So I saw it at the cinema with my friends and like definitely a bad film. Right. A very bad film. But Nicolas Cage was meant to play their villain in that film. And Seth Rogen, who was kind of had written the film and was a producer, couldn't get Cage to not play the villain with a Jamaican accent. And Rogan was like, it's just distracting. Please don't do it. And Cage was like,
wow.
If you stop me from doing this accent, I'll walk.
That's crazy.
And so like 2 days before filming, he was replaced by Christoph Waltz. And I love Christoph Waltz, but you watch all of the Green Hornet going, I wish Christoph Waltz was doing a Jamaican accent. Like you need, even though Cheadle is like, sticks out like a sore thumb, you need him.
Yeah.
Like you need the color.
Absolutely.
You need something a bit insane.
Totally.
Like a bit off the wall.
Yeah.
That's probably true.
There's also obviously problems in the Cage case of cultural appropriation. And like
yeah, I was going to say, like, what... When you say that he wanted to do a Jamaican accent, he didn't want to be Jamaican.
No, he wanted... Right. No. So that he wanted the backstory to be that, like, in order to be cool, the villain affects a Jamaican accent inside of the dog. Like Gary Oldman in True Romance.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That kind of works.
If you went to watch a theft movie, full stop, I'll recommend you this.
Thank you.
One of my mum's favourite movies. I can't find like a... Oh, here we go. Yay. So this person's top four films are Ocean's 11. Mission Impossible. Mission Impossible 2. And the recent Netflix original 365 Days, which everyone likes because it's got a lot of sex in it. That's all I know.
It's Polish or something, right? I feel like I've read an article about it.
Yeah, I work for a youth publication. That's how I know about 365 Days, because like teens are into it. I just gazing into everybody's eyes, walking around the table, talking to everyone one by one and being like, I think it's time for the walk, really, to be honest with you. Ida, we have to finish the podcast. I'm sorry.
I'm on just for the show.
Personally, movie expresses one of the most life-changing plots. And the movie itself is like a maze. In its crazy yet skillful ways, all members are team players. Theirs is a crazy amount of climactic moments that will truly leave you on the end of the seat.
Wow. It's interesting.
Thank you so much.
It's interesting to imagine like someone watching it and being like, wow, that had so many mini like moving parts. It was so intelligent. Like the way they did it was so masterful.
I mean, this is the point of the Letterboxd game, is you get to imagine other ways of being.
Therapist. English Don Cheadle isn't real. He cannot hurt you. English Don Cheadle in the corner of my room, like the hereditary grandma. Oi, you tosses. So that's a great review.
That is good.
See, everyone's just kind of just saying, like, this is a great movie. This isn't a movie, it's a magic trick. I mean, true. What is wrong with... I want people to, like... I want to find someone who's, like...
It was okay?
Forward. Yeah. But no one...
Just pick someone around.
All right, I'm going to do it.
Let's see what their movies are.
Okay. This person's top four favourite films. Holy majoli. 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Classic. Like,
canonised film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Good, the Bad and the Ugly.
Sure.
Canonised film. The Godfather.
Yeah.
Canonised film. Troy. Brad Pitt's Troy. So
here comes the personality.
Whoa. Crazy. Their favourite directors are Quentin Tarantino, Christopher Nolan, Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg. So...
And Michael Haneke,
exactly. Still one of the greatest endings in movie history for me. It was one of my absolute favourite classical pieces ever. Both Together Again is Goosebumps. Eighth Watch, and definitely the saddest of all, R.I.P. Carl Reiner.
Oh, that was fast. Yeah.
Not seen much of you, but in this trilogy, you've always been a highlight. Makes this ending even more emotional.
Oh.
Ian, Carl, 2020 goes on. Ian? Home. Ian Holm from The Lord of the Rings.
Yes. I guess 2020 is something greater. I mean, Ian Holm, very sad.
Very sad.
But like a lot of other stuff has happened as well.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. We have additional concerns on top of the death of Bilbo Baggins. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been so glad. Alex, what are we going to do talking about Oceans 12 and 13? Because we don't know how we're going to approach those movies. You have to, like, are they good movies? Have you seen them? And we just need your emotional support to get through 12 and 13. 12 is meant to be bad.
12? Okay, so I haven't seen 12 in a long time, but I did read the Wikipedia plot summary for Ocean's 12, and I was like, this does not sound like a good movie.
Julia Roberts pretends to be herself. We'll have fun. We'll do it in two films time. Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
I have a book called Parenthetical Bodies, which you can get through Subbed In.
Fantastic book.
And I play in a band called Sports Bra, which you can look up on the internet, I guess. Yes.
Fantastic band. You write for NME, Australia.
It's true.
Also, great publication. Great articles. You wrote a great thing about Party Dozen the other day.
Oh,
great band.
That album is so good.
It is really good. So listeners of the Brad Pittcast, go and listen to Party Dozen. Pray for Party Dozen is what the record is called. It's such a great title. Also, while you're at it, rate and review this podcast.
Mm.
Send an email to thebradpittcast@gmail.com.
Just if you want to point out any...
Explain the plot of Ocean's 11 to us.
Please do.
We can deal with this next week, but we got a great email from Will. I don't know if you saw
it. Did we? I did not see it.
Yeah.
Oh.
So
next week.
Next week. We'll be
We've got to do a non-pit. We haven't done a non-pit for ages.
That's true.
And then we'll do emails on that one.
Yeah.
So if you want to send in emails, a mailbag.
Oh, yeah, mailbag. Yeah. So thebradpittcast@gmail.com. Questions, comments, praise, etc.
And review it. And if you leave a good review of the Brad Pittcast, then you get to pick a non-pit film cover. Salo. 120 Days of Salo.
Absolutely not.
See you next week for...
I don't know. Thank you so much, everyone.
Stay safe.
Bye.
Bye.